online at kpfa.org. It is now 2 p.m. Stay with us for the Visionary Activist.
Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, yes, last night I went to the Goldman Environmental Prize Awards here in D.C. as we continue to cross-pollinate Washington, D.C. and California, because they need each other literally and symbolically. But, of course, the Goldman Environmental Prize Awards make one proud to be human. So many good humans really doing brave, dedicated, and genius things to heal human relationship to the earth. So first also, I will be doing an interview on a free telesummit, The Power of Interconnection. I like that title very much, and I love the organizer, Julia Griffin, Interconnection, because let's say we throw everything into the cauldron, all philosophy, science, spiritual teachings, everything going, does it guide everybody to their own true autonomy? Excellent. We ladle it out. No, we throw it back in. So I will be doing an interview with her. The free telesummit runs May 6th through the 16th. My interview will be Sunday, May 10th, Mother's Day. You can find out more about that at onetrueself.com/summit-2015. So today it is perfect. Let me weave a nest for our wonderful guest. Right now, as we are talking, during the course of this hour, the moon in Cancer, Big Mama Earth, will be exactly trining Neptune, Ocean Sea. That will be at 2:23 p.m. today, and so we're going to be riding that. Oh, yes, powerful vision. We know that Mercury and Mars are straight up overhead, over Berkeley right now. In Taurus, let us be energetic voice for the Earth herself. Mars, let us take all positive woofy yang and liberate it from the tyrannical confines of war and put it into green man soil and activity, because Mars and Mercury are trining Pluto, god of soil, god of the underworld. Meanwhile, the sun in Taurus has this beautiful degree. The rainbow's pot of gold shines shimmering in the mist, and it is at a quirky 90-degree angle to Ceres Demeter, a dwarf planet, goddess of the Earth, whose image is the Council of Ancestors. Young leader listens to their voices. Well, let's think of all of us as young leaders listening to their voices, and let's think of the ancestors speaking to us from even over 252 million years ago with their admonishment. We will explain, because today we are doing sea-soil solutions, healing the seas by healing the soil. We welcome back our ally, John Rulak, Green Man Biz Wizard, CEO of Nutiva, Nutiva.com, offering his guiding pragmatic lucidity. Regenerative agriculture can save our planet. Many posts are up there. Welcome, John Rulak.
Good to be here, Caroline. Thank you for having me on the show, and hope you're having a great day.
Pretty good, and all the better for your lucid self. Again, many times on show you've explained many horrible things. We're going to explain some horrible and wonderful things, but I just can't help myself, too. Can you just remind us about soy protein isolate on just one side, and then we'll get down to our central theme of the ocean? And just because so many people don't know still, you know, you want to read the ingredients carefully.
Right. So the basic thing is to understand is that 98% of all soy, corn, canola, sunflower grown in the United States is crushed using a toxic process called hexane. And it's a way to extract more fat from the seed cake. And it's a byproduct of making gasoline. And then people take that byproduct and sell it to natural food stores as healthy, quote, healthy soy protein isolate.
Yes, and if we can get that out of our systems, we might be able to think straight. All right, and we're going to honor thinking straight, too, because you had directed my attention worthily to article, Ocean Acidification Drove Earth's Last Earth's largest mass extinction 252 million years ago that killed most life on Earth. 90% of all marine species, 70% of all terrestrial species died due to massive amounts of CO2 released from volcanoes into the ocean. Yes, well, take it from there. Why? What sparked you in this article?
Well, this article talks about the issue, what happens when oceans becoming very acidic. And so 252 million years ago, that was the largest, they did a carbon analysis just recently. It was embedded in the news. And how that ties together and kind of what we're talking about today is there's a major environmental issue that basically is not really talked about, and that is the fact that We're all talking about how much carbon is up in the atmosphere, and you can ask people, well, how much carbon is there? And a lot of people say, well, I remember we'd like it to be 350, but now it's 400 parts per million. But they don't talk about what's going on in the oceans. And the oceans, that carbon is falling into the oceans, and the oceans are becoming acidic. And so why is that important? People might say, you know, why do we care if the ocean becomes a bit more acidic? Well, two out of three of our breaths come from the phytoplankton, which are the essentially the oxygen machinery or production for the planet. And as the ocean becomes more acidic, the phytoplankton is slowly starting to die. So unless we course correct, we are going to repeat what might have happened 252 million years ago when the ocean is becoming too acidic, and most species in the ocean and also the land perished.
Now, this is also important just for everybody to put on their altar to ruminate on. It was published in Science magazine on April 10th this year. So it's much worse than the dinosaurs die off, which was a mere 65 million years ago. Okay, this is 252 million years ago. And it is our ancestors, not just humans, but all the ocean are going, don't do this again, you humans. So that sparked you and one of your recent posts in EchoWatch.com, The Solution Under Our Feet, How Regenerative Organic Agriculture Can Save the Planet and the Ocean. All right. Because even now some geoengineering types going, well, let's just sequester more, you know, carbon in the ocean. We go, no, already, the little shells are dissolving, the visible thing that we can see already, the ocean's in grave danger from this acidification, from this dangerously acid direction pH. So maybe guide us through again your enthusiasm and your exhortation. What should we do? In your article, you say if you take away one thing from this article, I want it to be this quote. Do you have that quote handy?
Right, I do.
Excellent.
This is by a Ohio State soil scientist, Dr. Ratan Lal. A mere 2% increase in the carbon content of the planet's soils could offset 100% of all greenhouse gas emissions going into the atmosphere. So that's a hitty quote. And essentially, nature wants the carbon back in the soil. The carbon that's up in the atmosphere that many scientists and people are saying this is a real concern. It's impacting our weather, and it's going to create all sorts of environmental catastrophes, which we're starting to see. So the idea is instead of saying, well, okay, let's only focus our energy on reducing the amount we put up into the atmosphere and doing solar and wind and all those are all good things and using walking or using your bicycle more, etc. Those are all important things. But what about if we could take that carbon and put it back where it rightly belonged? I mean, that's kind of what you learn in kindergarten. You put things where it belong and you don't put things where they shouldn't be. So we kind of learned that was a kindergarten lesson. And so now the question is can we as a society and in our organizations, whether it's business or nonprofits or schools, learn that we can take that carbon that's floating up in the atmosphere and put it into the soil through regenerative agriculture, through composting, through cover crops, and through organic regenerative agriculture. So it's so simple, and it makes so much sense. But as one of the was one of the authors of an article called Nature Wants Her Carbon Back, Larry Copald from Carbon Underground, which is a great website, Carbon Underground. He writes, how is it possible that with the entire planet focusing on reducing CO2 emissions, we're not even paying lip service to the single largest contributor, which is agriculture. Agriculture contributes more greenhouse gases than Chevron, Exxon, and the entire transportation industry combined. And that fact is virtually unknown. And if you read recently Obama and the Secretary of Agriculture for his administration had some announcement this week about they're going to try to help ranchers and farmers do a little better job, but they said, well, agriculture contributes 9%, and that's really an incorrect number, and they don't actually count the production of fertilizer or the transportation of fertilizer, which is very, very harsh on the environment. It's actually more like 20 to 30%. And this article, Nico, watch, I go into this, and it's one of these ironies that we have the actual solution, and if we focus on it, the good news is, if as a society we focus on this and people changed the food that they buy, and then thus the farmers will change what they grow if we change what we buy, that within a matter of a decade or so, we can bring from 400 parts per million, which is on the way to 450 parts per million now if we don't do anything, we can bring it down to 350 parts per million and really make a major contribution to the future of our society and future of the planet.
No, that's great. I just want to even repeat what you just said and what you wrote so that we can all absorb it into our molecules. That the big oil companies, as you write, Exxon, Chevron, and Shell have been perceived as the main climate villains. Yet now the growing movement of carbon cycle literate people realize that Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta, and Big Ag are much worse. As you write, we now know that 20 to 30% of all man-made greenhouse gases in the atmosphere come from industrial agriculture. Chemicals are for cars. By dumping agricultural chemicals onto our soil, we disrupt nature's delicate balance of water, soil, and air. So this is very much, you know, partnering, and maybe just, you know, guide us into the, you know, our word human comes from humus, right? We are, and humble. We got humble. Humus, human, humble, same meaning, same root. We're meant to be humble in the dirt, people. But, you know, just remind us again of the rich humus, H-U-M-U-S. Guide us into the mysteries of humus, John Black.
Yeah. Well, there's a thing to, we all talk about the atmosphere. And so one of my goals is to get people to become aware of the humusphere.
Ah, yes.
And there's a whole humusphere that's under our feet. And that thin, rich layer is teeming with biological activity from microbes and bacteria and soil microorganisms. And the more carbon that we put into the soil, they feed on it and grow. And so there's a whole rich diversity in the soil, and regenerative agriculture honors the soil. Industrial agriculture using GMO technology with toxic herbicides and pesticides and chemical fertilizers slowly destroy the microbial activity. If you take a teaspoon of soil from an organic farmer with good practices and a teaspoon of soil from industrial agriculture, it's like night and day. There's so much more biological activity.
And just to go back to Kristen Olson, the soil will save us. I will be planning to have her again on the show. You've reminded me, John Rulak, in the next month. That would be really great. So many humans are working on this now. But she says, you know, again, reminds us there's a vast kingdom of creatures under our feet, billions of microorganisms in a tablespoon of soil that take the carbon dioxide that plants pull from the atmosphere and turn it into life-giving soil carbon. And so she's gone around and, you know, and scattered around on visionary scientists and farmers and foodies and ranchers and landscapers whose work shows that the earth can be healed, and offering the hope that these intractable problems like climate change, air and water pollution, food quality, and even obesity have the same very low-tech solution. So, yeah, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So again, to remind us, we go, all right, we put CO2 back into the soil with composting, cover crops, you said.
Different polycultures, different crops. Organic regenerative farmers might grow six or seven different crops, and each one puts something back different into the soil and creates a different terrain for the soil. So that's really, really important. The thing to understand a little about this whole carbon dioxide and CO2, the idea is that there's three carbon sinks in this planet. So there's the atmosphere, which we know a lot about, and then there's the oceans and the soil. So the two out of three of them are maxed out right now. And which are those? That's the atmosphere and the oceans. To be a healthy biosystem, we can't put more CO2. We're getting a lot of signs that we're maxing that out. And the oceans have become 30% more acidic, according to the research, institutions in America over the last 50 years. So the only place that we can put the carbon to balance out and come more in balance with nature is into the soil.
In your understanding, would us going that way, would the oceans start to alkali their pH on their own if we, again, lift the stress off?
The idea is that the oceans are becoming more and more acidic, and because of the carbon dioxide, that's the major contributor, and also because of the increased heat is also causing issues for the oceans. So the oceans are becoming hotter and more acidic. So when we bring the carbon into the soil, then there won't be so much carbon in the atmosphere, and it won't fall into the ocean. So then the oceans can rebuild. And to give you an idea of the challenge we're facing the oceans. Very sad situation right now. Thousands and thousands of sea lions have washed up. Young sea lion pups have washed up dead in the beaches in California in the last 6 months because the food system, off the coast of California is changing. And to give you an idea how severe, Washington State and Maine, these are two states that are generally not necessarily liberal bastions. These are more conservative, states, ranchers, farmers, fisher folk who live there and control the politics. And both of those have state commissions now where they're producing reports with scientists showing that they're very concerned in Maine that the lobsters are going to have a hard time producing the shells. So they're concerned what's going to happen to their lobster populations and fishermen because the population's going to start dropping. And then oysters are not able to produce the shell like they have now in certain regions in Washington State. So here's an example of two states that are sounding the alarm on this, this is obviously not the greatest news people want to hear about. We hear a lot of bad news in the media. The good news is that if we become aware of this and can shift how we grow food in the world, which through social media and through an empowered people who purchase food, we can do that. And in a matter of a decade, we can turn this around and change this. But that's going to take the effort of a lot of people to do that. And that's one of the reasons why companies like Whole Foods and Chipotle, et cetera, are expanding. Their stocks are going up, and companies like Kellogg's and other companies are starting to drop because the demand is shifting. So there is a process that's starting to change in a positive way right now, but we need to accelerate it much faster.
Yeah, and one of the main themes of the people who received the Goldman Environmental Prize last night and also in San Francisco last week, but wonderful, wonderful. But a lot of it is in Scotland, protecting the ocean from these rakes that scrape the bottom many times and kill everything in search for scallops. And we go, "Dow!" And against all odds, this wonderful Scottish man, created a marine sanctuary. Haiti, same thing. And we go, small The small collection of islands known as Palau has a proposal of a marine sanctuary ban on fishing the size of the Ukraine. We go, all right, supporting all of these things, taking the pressure off so it can be rebound, and again, back to you. These crucial practices, because here you are so admirably, the captain of Nutiva, Nutiva.com, and whenever I run into you, I go, oh, best coconut oil, and chia seeds, but also, what do you doing, what's the palm oil thing? And you go, well, we've found a way to harvest palm oil in a non-harmful way, right?
Correct, down in Ecuador.
Ah.
And so we're palm has a yield over 12 times per hectare than soy oil. So it's actually a lower carbon footprint to grow palm oil in Ecuador and ship it here to California, distribute across the United States, than to grow organic soy oil here in America. So that's an interesting perspective a lot of people may not be aware of.
Right, because that's one of the major devastations of in Indonesia, right? I mean, it's the cutting down of forests and the death of orangutans,
destroying
all of that.
Palm flicked,
is that what you call it?
Palm oil conflict.
Palm oil conflict, yes.
There's a campaign by Rainforest Action Network. And one thing I wanted to, here's a great quote from Tom Newmark, who is the ex-CEO of New Chapter, and he's co-founder of Carbon Underground. And for the environmentalists out there, I definitely encourage you to take this in. And this is a very powerful quote. Many NGOs view carbon and agriculture as, quote, the enemy. The regenerative movement sees carbon as our friend and agriculture as our natural ally to help our friend carbon return to the land. And so the irony of ironies is as a longtime environmentalist, I see the climate movement, from 350.org to Sierra Club, while well-intentioned and doing lots of good work to educate people about the concerns of burning more fossil fuel, they are not discussing and not sharing what we're talking about here and the acidification of the ocean and the link between agriculture and ocean health and CO2 levels. And that is and matter of fact, there's even publications like Grist Magazine. They don't even want to publish anything on it. And so ironically, you have the major organizations like Monsanto and Dow and the USDA they're not going to be our friends in this battle because they're part of the problem. Yet the major NGOs are actually enabling this to continue on, because if you ask the members of 350.org if they know what we're talking about, they've never even heard of this. Yet they get emails and information. I mean, it goes even further. Like when the New York Times covers the climate summit, they're going to do a climate summit in Paris, and we've had many of them over the last year or two. They'll do articles, and there's not one tweet, not one Facebook, not one sentence in any of those talking about soil sequestration, which is and not only does it improve the CO2 and carbon cycle balance, but it conserves water. It provides more nutrition for the soil and also for the food we grow on it. So there's so many benefits, but it's this kind of irony of ironies. I just go like, what can be done? And I ran into an environmental organization, Amazon Watch, which Nutiva supports, and they're working to protect the rainforest in the Amazon and working with indigenous tribes there. They've invited me to come over and speak to different environmental NGOs in the Bay Area here next month. So we're looking forward to trying to shift people's awareness on this issue.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I'm just going to repeat what you said so we can all absorb it so that it can percolate in through our systems, because after you gave the great Tom Newmark quote in your piece in Echo Watch, the challenge is that the enemies of all things natural, you write, i.e. Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta, may there be allies in there somehow, are culture jamming in hope that the regenerative message won't go viral. So, one, you're saying, well, our own team, until now, right, has been resistant resistant to putting this this crucial solution understanding in place. And then you say Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta, culture jamming. So how do you, I mean, yes, but can you delineate how they're culture jamming and hope that the regenerative message won't go viral?
Well, first off, they issue statements like they made sure when the major media talked this week about Earth Day and how agriculture is going to help contribute to climate change, they used the number of 9%. Agriculture contributes 9%, which is incorrect. It's actually 20 to 30%, and may well be even more than that. But 20 to 30% is a more conservative number. So they're misrepresenting the role of agriculture's contribution to climate change. Secondly, they've over 50% of all agricultural research in America today is funded by Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta. So it used to be 40 years ago, research in seed breeding was done by was publicly funded, but because of tax policy changes and inflation and lobbying, etc. Now the majority of funding, if you're a professor at university, do you think your department chair in agriculture or research wants you to publish a study that would show that if we continue on our current path in agriculture, that we would kill all the species in the oceans? Do you think Monsanto is going to want to fund the next year's endowment for that university?
No, but humble humans dedicated to humus will rise. That's right, exactly. So yes, we do want humble humans dedicated to humus to rise. And I know you've gone over this, you know, many times on this show and also in many of your venues. But there are still, you know, grown-ups. I know many grown-up scientists, and there's Bill Gates and everything going, you know, if you're not for GMOs, you want to starve Africa. And we go, you know, and it can give us conniption fits. But you're so good at this, John. When grown-up science guys going, only this will save Africa, only this will save the world, only, you know, you guys just don't know. How do you lucidly guide the people receiving that, and then how might you guide those guys? How do you lucidly guide them out of that compelling illusion?
Sometimes when people's, you know, current reality of what they consider is their truth, sometimes it's not always easy to persuade people. So I think what I focus on is who's open to it and shifting that. Though ironically, I've been invited to give a keynote speech to a group of 250 CPG food executives, and Monsanto is a keynote on day two, and they wanted someone to give a counter position to Monsanto on day three. So next week I'll see how I'm doing on that subject with executives from, you know, General Mills and Nestle, et cetera. So that should be entertaining.
Are you going to be irresistibly eloquent in your invitation to them to see sanity and even, well, I guess you can't quite pitch profit to them at this point, because I mean you know, the agriculture of poison is so mega profitable, but a slightly longer vision.
Actually, my whole point is that it may not matter whether people believe that GMOs are safe or not, or that industrial agriculture is toxic for ecosystems. But millennials are not interested in the food that the large companies like General Mills and et cetera are selling, and that's why they bought Annie's, and that's why they're having layoffs and closing factories, because the large CPG companies, and that's why Kraft just merged with Heinz, because they're losing market share. And so it may not matter whether they believe it or not, but what's important is their customers are voting with their dollars, and they're losing share, and they're losing their customer base. But in terms of whether GMO is going to feed the world, essentially, GMOs will destroy our world, because we've lost half of our soil, and industrial GMO agriculture is basis on using 98% of of all the GMO crops that have been developed are basis of using more herbicides and putting pesticides in every cell inside the corn. So we're actually, the whole basis of it is using more toxic chemicals, and we have to go to a regenerative system where we're not relying on chemical systems to produce food. But it's a cultural thing. Farmers are been taught this way in the land grant university. So it's like the farmers are not wrong. You know, they're not bad people. They're just doing what they've been taught and what they've known. And also the thing about using GMO technology, the Roundup, where you basically they grow in plants that you spray herbicides on. You can spray more and more quantities of herbicides. It takes less labor, so that's one of the reasons why they like that. But it's a process to educate people. But it's not always so easy to change someone's mind. If they want to tap into a new market, and also younger generations of farmers are now also concerned about these environmental issues, and when they realize it can also take baby steps, when they realize they can do certain things like planting a cover crop, these large corn and soy farmers, even though they're GMO, they can plant a cover crop during the winter time, which will sequester carbon and will hold more moisture in the soil. So these farmers are now, many farmers are switching over to non-GMO this season as we speak, so to supply the growing market, and they can save money on less technology transfer fee to Monsanto and have a growing market and get a premium on that. So it's kind of agriculture is kind of up for grabs right now, which direction it's going to go to, you know, here for the next decade.
No, and I like encouragement and critique as incentives. You know, a million years ago on the show when I hosted Sally Fallon, she said, most big supermarkets, they deal in huge amounts of volume, but their profit margin is just 3%. So she was saying just a little teeny, tip of people's consumption patterns, it's just 3%. I mean, the reason they're making so much money is, again, because of volume, and we go, it's just, now, some people said, well, you put the pressure on big supermarkets, they'll just, outsource, pay people less in third world countries or whatever. And we go, try everything. And then I know a person who was working, decades ago, I guess, on Walmart's environmental realm. And I go, really? And he goes, well, try everything, try to put them out of business and then try to guide them as well. Let everybody try everything. So in a way, as you present to the CPGs, planting cover crops in winter, even if your crop is a GMO, we'll seal the carbon and keep the water in the soil. So even if you're doing this thing, you can do this one simple thing. There we go.
Exactly. And there was a recent article showing how Target has brought in a new executive team, and it quoted like an unidentified CPG executive, consumer packaged good food executive, that they were concerned that Target is reducing the shelf space for the General Mills and the Kraft Foods. So they're actually losing shelf space, and who are they giving it to? They're giving more space to Annie's and Nutiva. Now is Target is putting our products in there, and Plum Organics, and a whole range of different companies, because the consumers are voting, and that's the big thing. We may complain about all these organizations from Monsanto to, et cetera, but as long as we invest in their stocks, through our people's pension plans and teachers' pension plans, and long as we purchase their products, they're going to be in power. And when we shift that, so in a way, every time we buy a product that has Monsanto technology in it, we are saying, go Monsanto. I want to go to a restaurant and I want to give my money so we can grow more foods with toxic chemicals to poison the oceans.
No, I want you to hold that. I want you to delineate that. But you are being so compelling and fascinating. We blew right past the half hour mark, and so we're going to have a very short break. Thank you, Berkeley. A very short break. Our guest today is John Rulak. We will be right back to delineate more horror and wonderfulness about what we can do and how the soil is eager to sequester the carbon that is killing the ocean. This is Caroline Casey, Visionary Activist Show, and we'll be right back after a very short break.
consolation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Lost him down.
Channy, 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 come blow my channy home. Channy, channy, come blow my channy home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show here on KPFA 94.1. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and today our splendid guest is John Rulak, Green Man Business Wizard, Nutiva.com, offering his guiding pragmatic lucidity on regenerative agriculture can save the planet and, again, the soil, eager to sequester the carbon and save the ocean by doing that. So I always love it when you go into a guiding critique, so I interrupted you mid-thing, but you go, do we really want to go to a restaurant and give all our money to GMOs? Well, what are we consuming without knowing it, just for the fun of it? When we go to a restaurant, right. Yeah, what are we consuming?
Well, when you buy GMO foods, what you're downloading into your body is bacteria and viruses that have created in a lab and have been injected in at the DNA level. So when the people they love to say, the GMO industry likes to say, there's no difference between non-GMO corn and GMO corn. They'll say that's just like a breeding practice. We've always been doing GMO for thousands of years, but there's a big difference between selective breeding, where they may take a different type of potato and try that. Or you create a plumquat with an apricot and a plum, you know, something a similar, you know, similar species. But with GMOs, it's a completely different process. But you're actually consuming viruses and bacteria that they've never done any long-term studies. The average study done in GMOs is 90 days. That's what Monsanto, that's what DuPont, when they create these new foods, these GMO foods, they do for 90 days. Then when we did the first study that was done in the world for 2 years, Seralini did this, where they fed rats GMO grains, and they also gave them low levels below, very low levels of Roundup in the water as a separate study. A separate test protocol. When that happened, it went all around. It was green, a lot of media, and then they attacked it. And they actually got the study. Monsanto got the study to be withdrew. They appointed actually an editor who worked for this publication and who had ties to Monsanto. And then they withdrew the study. And they all said it should be disrespected, and it shouldn't even be looked at. And the media repeated that ad nauseum. Now they realized that this editor was causing problems. They fired the editor, let that person go, and it was in all. There was nothing that the study said that was done. It was like they didn't withhold evidence. It wasn't fraudulent. There was no protocol in scientific publications that could justify withdrawing this study, but they were able to do that, and so. This is the concern that people need to realize, is that whenever there is any good science, the scientists are attacked, and that's why people are concerned about for their own careers when they see this. They did the same thing to a well-known researcher around GMO potato in England. It's unfortunate that science has basically compromised by the economic interests, and so people just need to be aware of that.
Yeah, I was curious, you know, last night on The Daily Show, Asif Manvi, who's usually pretty savvy, did a piece on GMOs, and he talks to a critic who then reveals that he has no credentials, and then he talks to a science guy who goes, oh, it is more complex, this GMO potato, actually perfectly wonderful, perfectly harmless, no problem. In fact, it's the anti-GMO people who are, you know, driving up the price and making all the GMOs, you know, centralized in Monsanto, so the smaller companies can't do it, so it's actually the anti-GMO people who are the problem, you know, and Asif Manvi goes, oh, my goodness, oh, again, we go, oh, even there. The GMO potato, which was being defended really last night on the Daily Show, of all places, what can you tell us about the GMO potato?
Well, they worked on a GMO potato in England, and the researcher who was a well-established, a long-time researcher in a
Uh-oh. We lost you. We lost you. We will call you back right away. Perhaps it was the GMO squad. We don't know exactly. And while we are regaining connection, overcoming whatever it is to regain John Rulak on his landline to Kahoot with us, things that we are pulling up that we've been working on, you know, in life and on this show for a very long time. Years ago, when doing so much work on GMOs, I want to do a shout out to our food ally, Claire Cummings, also for coming up with this crucial metaphor. When I had many, biologists on show, and I go, well, the science, grown-ups say, you know, we have always done this. We've always experimented in this way. And they would say, no, we have never cut DNA. And where Claire offered her metaphor, that I borrowed, is, might we liken this to cutting our ancestral guidance when we cut DNA? And the scientists were like, yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's exactly the right metaphor. We're cutting off our ancestral guidance. And part of the mythic news right now, again, is theater for the earth and shows for the earth and everything in that way, as we are heading into this sensual time of Taurus going kinship with the earth, and here's composting, yes, yes, you little beings, and here's all the positive bacteria, we're going to out-enthuse the poisons, yes, enthusiasm poker. So remember also that as we are convening right now, you know, the moon trined Neptune a few minutes ago, but it says, you know, an inspirational vision of our collaborative kinship with the earth and with the forces of vitality. Because part of the dynamic is there's nothing more perfectly embodying, you know, empire and colonialism than the imposition of human will, scattered and ill-tutored though it be, you know, on our plant allies, going, we're going to impose this thing as opposed to collaborative partnering. We're going to put mackerel genes in this tomato because, you know, we're boys and we can. We go, Dodge. So we are still aspiring to get our, the GMO forces apparently have kidnapped John Rulak, but we're going to get him back from the underworld. Give John Rulak back from the underworld, you GMO beings and food and phone services as well. So I love, you know, again, the clarity of the overview, meaning we know, you know, Pluto and Capricorn, death and rebirth wants to be composted, you know, dominance, empire, colonialism, control, you know, going down, but taking so much life with it, you know, squares Uranus as part of our ongoing theme, culture of renaissance, reverent renaissance rising from the rubble, which is collaborative. You know, now we're going back to respect. We remember that the word respect means to look at, again, respectful and humble collaboration, you know, with the plant world and the animal world, going, how about this? Oh, there about that. All the things are brought into play. Everything we've ever loved or studied, you know, brought alive. And wanted to shout out to, again, Lakota Elder from years ago, crucial thing that I always carry in my magic backpack, in which he said, you know, we Lakota didn't hunt alone. We, those gifted at trance, and again, moon trine Neptune, we all have a capacity to do trance and to go backstage now. He said those gifted at trance would kind of go into a reverie and negotiate and broker a deal with the wolves and coyotes, and we would all hunt together for a season. And if you want to destroy a culture, this Lakota elder said many years ago on this show, then destroy that. Destroy the capacity to cooperate across species borders using all of our metaphysical and physical senses to do so. If you destroy that, you can walk all over them. So we want to regain this. Again, it is our meta-mystic, you know, and rational selves equally cahooting and dancing with each other that want to be brought back into play. And again, just a clarity, that which is dominance and imposing human will on top of the rest of our kin in this planet and nature is part of the empire colonialism that's going back down, and that which is a collaborative, you know, cooperate with everything, is allied with nature's evolutionary ingenuity. And we have John Rulak back. Welcome back from
Hello.
The underworld. Did Monsanto kidnap you for 2 seconds and take you on a spaceship and then deposit you back here?
No, just I don't know. We had some technical difficulties, but we're back live. And I was just explaining how this respected researcher in the UK that was doing research on the GMO potato, his whole career was destroyed, and the researcher's executive director got a call from Tony Blair's office. And they did a press conference the day before and talked about these concerns and about the issue of GMO potato. He was an advocate for GMO potato, but then he saw the results and he was forced out and his career was destroyed. There are several professors at University of California, Berkeley here who one of them showed how Monsanto's GMO corn was contaminating the indigenous varieties, heirloom varieties of corn in Mexico, and Monsanto and other GMO industries did not like this, and they did a campaign and almost forced him out to have to leave University of California, Berkeley. So this is a common trait that Monsanto is doing. To give you an example, a week ago, Dr. Oz had a show on the issue around GMOs and labeling, and the concern about the World Health Organization recently came out and showed that Roundup, the most popular herbicide used for weeds, is probably linked to cancer. So they invited Monsanto, they invited the biotech industry, and they didn't want to show up. And they had some other some guests that were for GMO labeling, so there was a no-show. They refused to come on TV and talk about it, so that's interesting. And then a week later, Columbia University, where Dr. Oz is a well-respected surgeon, received a letter saying that he should be removed because he's anti-GMO. And Dr. Oz, here they're saying he's anti-GMO. Dr. Oz has never said GMOs are dangerous. He just says, we think we should have the right to know if there is GMOs and we should have labeling. And he always brings on pro and con people on the issue. But just even to that, they were so upset and these 10 people wrote the article. He recently came back and did a show and showed some of these people had links, you know, to Monsanto. One of them, Dr. Henry Miller, worked for the tobacco industry as a consultant, said tobacco doesn't cause cancer in the last decade, he stated that. And
And we'll have to surmise the end of that interesting sentence, but I can fill in again while we rescue John Rulak from the Monsanto underworld to restore his voice. Because the show the subject that John Rulak is just referencing, I did just hear the news story driving to the studio just now that Mehmet Oz, seven colleagues or alleged colleagues at Columbia wrote a letter. Now, at first, you know, here's where we want to be unmanipulatable, because at first the way it was presented, you go, right, yes, Dr. Oz, he does present many funky things, like, just suspect things, although the piece on radio didn't mention any of these, but we sort of know it's kind of, you know, iffy. Nobody has ever attacked his record as head of surgery in the neuro department at Columbia, but then he has the kind of popular realm. But they didn't make the connection that John Rulak just did about the GMO labeling as attacking, you know, as attracting his critics. And but they did do a sober, reflective comeback, because they did then, you know, examine the backgrounds of these seven people, and they had major industry tie-ups and stuff. But they, I didn't know it was not presented as lucidly as John Rulak just did for us. We don't know. John Rulak has disappeared into the mists, apparently. But we will see if we can get him back. There we go. We don't know. These intriguing things, because there are many things. You know, the last time we had John Rulak on show, also a wonderful ally, you know, said, ask him if there's any non-GMO corn left. And he said, well, probably not. You know, the facts that he was just referencing, University of California, Berkeley, microbiologist, you know, again, who retained his seat. But that man also had, you know, death threats as well as academic loss of livelihood threats. And we go, right, but this is rising up. And as we, you know, as we link all things together, again, the tipping point of sane reverence into application and even funding, and, you know, the larger irresistible story. The larger irresistible story, and John Rulak is back. Okay, jump in anywhere. Where I'd left us is I had just heard the public radio reporting on Dr. Oz. They didn't mention the Roundup thing, but they did mention the questionable, sketchy background of his critics. But I'd just taken us also to the last time you were on the show. Somebody asked, "Is there any non-GMO corn left?" And you had said, "No."
There is, yeah, oh. Yeah. There is non-GMO corn, and they've actually developed a non-GMO GMO corn variety that does not allow GMO corn pollen to come in and impact the integrity of the plant and the seed. So that is quite exciting.
Ooh, wait, yes, no. Say more about that. How does that work?
So I'm not quite sure of how they did it, but they have a corn variety that you can grow next to GMO corn, and it doesn't. It, for some reason, they've allowed it so the GMO traits that would blow in from the pollen do not express itself in the non-GMO corn on the next season when they grow the crop. So that's quite fascinating.
And did they persuade the plants to do this? They did not GMO them.
No, it's through some sort of selective breeding process. So that's interesting. But what I was saying, I don't know if you heard this, is that these attacks from the scientists, the potato researcher in the UK, to Dr. Oz, these are attacks because they're only doing this because we're actually winning. So the regenerative organic agriculture is now becoming a force in the marketplace, and Monsanto and the large CPG companies that sell their products are losing market share. And so they're just attacking. And so it's like we celebrate that.
We do. And I just wanted also to tie into 2 weeks ago when hosting David Bloom. I mean, part of his ingenuity, and again, the ethanol being funded and all kinds, is that he goes to polluters, you know, again, beet sugar people from which we get most of our sugar. And then they have this extra kind of beet slurry water that they try and dump into the rivers, which, of course, is harmful to the rivers. And then they get regulation, and they still try and get around it. And he goes to them and says, what you consider waste is not waste. Here, give me that. And I will turn it into alcohol, and here, that way you'll make even more money, and you'll be a more responsible citizen and less polluting. And they're like, oh, fine, okay. So again, the luring over, going, here you go, no, this will work for you. There, no, you'll like this. This really, in the slightly longer term, this is going to be a good thing.
Definitely. And I wanted to mention a few projects and organizations that we work with in this area that people, listeners might enjoy. One is, there's a group called Kiss the Ground, and the son of the founders of Cafe Gratitude, here in the Bay Area. It's based in Los Angeles, and they are working on a 5-minute story of soil, just like the story of stuff. And the same person who created that, Lewis Fox, who's a great storyteller and animator. Okay. So that's going to be coming out in June, and Jason Mraz, the musician, is going to be going to be kicking the introduction of that off in June, and the TIV is a sponsor of that, and that's going to be a great way to encapsulate everything we've been talking about, but in an animated, powerful story version in 5 minutes. So that's something that we can look forward to.
And when you say Nutiva is going to sponsor that, meaning again, you're going to do what?
Well, we're contributing $10,000, and I'm also an advisor to them along with Paul Hawken.
Uh-huh.
To help this organization, tell the story about soil. And they're doing a lot of good work. They were recently invited back to Washington, D.C., and they did a presentation to our illustrious politicians in Washington, D.C., and teaching them about soil.
Excellent. That's great. No, that's right. And you're reminding me of many teammates. A little shout out to Lewis Fox. Hello there. Okay. That's good.
And there's a couple other groups that I wanted to mention.
Please, yes.
There's the Marin Carbon Project, which is based in Marin, and the Carbon Cycle Institute, which they're part of, and they have a very powerful project where they're working with the University of California, Berkeley, and the National Soil Research Conservation Group, which has agents all over the federal government employees that are working on soil issues. And they've demonstrated that you can apply a thin layer of compost on rangelands and increase the amount of carbon sequestration substantially. And so they're working on projects. Governor Brown's has visited them. The Chinese government has, and they're doing a lot of positive. I had a meeting with Paul Hawken, which is very fascinating with what they're doing. Paul Hawken's working on carbon drawdown, on showing all sorts of different ways we can draw down the carbon and reduce carbon from LED light bulbs to holistic grazing and. One of the things that the Carbon Cycle Institute is working on is that, well, the perception is that cows are the problem, that instead of using industrial confinement of cows where they're locked up in pens like you drive down Highway 5 with Harris Ranch, you can allow cows to graze on the grass where cows are meant to do and sequester carbon. And there's a whole process on that. And so they're showing some very interesting research on that and changing the grass from annual to perennial grasses, which again hold more water. So it's very important. This can actually conserve water in California. Instead of the water rushing off the hills, it seeps in and goes in and capture that water. So that's really important. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is there's a great conference in September that I've been organizing and sponsoring called Soil Not Oil, and it's going to be at the City of Richmond Civic Center, and that's going to be September 4th and 5th with a large protest in San Francisco march on September 6th. And so that there'll be people from all over the world, including Vandana Shiva, others are going to be coming to speak there, including several organizations I've just mentioned. And we're hoping to get a couple thousand people there to basically teach those foodies in the Bay Area that want to learn more about this issue and become climate, carbon literate people and learn about these issues. And there still needs to be more science and more research on this, but it's something that I'm optimistic about, that we can make a change. And it's like imagine if we were on a spaceship flying through space and someone was operating a system that was going to destroy the oxygen in the Earth. Would you do something about it? And essentially that's what Earth is flying through space and industrial agriculture is killing the oceans, our oxygen generator, and we need to make a course correction. And so when you buy food, you're making a vote. Are we voting for regenerative organic agriculture where we put carbon in the soil, or are we going to vote for a system such that Monsanto
we're on our way out.
DuPont, all that stuff. And that's going to not honor the soil.
Exactly.
So we need to make that shift.
We are going to make that shift. And we will do more on this fabulous conference, Soil Not Oil Conference, September 4th and 5th in Richmond. That's really great. Thank you so much, John Rulak, Nutiva.com. Always lucid and great. Let us keep perpetually cahooting in some form. That is really wonderful. Thanks so much to the Berkeley Board Op team. Hello. And to Alex Berwinskas in Washington, D.C. I'm Caroline Casey. Follow me on Twitter at Stand Up Coyote and also on Facebook at Coyote Network News. Woof, 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 when we will reconvene next week. Thanks so much. And thanks again, John Rulak.
You. Have a great day.
Woof.
When you think of the Hard Knock, you think of that.
Station of Resistance.
One of the most phenomenal beats of all time.
Good information and great radio.
News, views, and hip-hop.
What? Do it the way you feel it.
Hard Knock.
Hard Knock.
Hard Knock Radio.
Monday through Friday.
And it's from 4 to 5 p.m. knocking hard in your area.
94.1 KPFA.
Only revolution is our evolution.
So good.
Here's another community-powered announcement from KPFA.
Jamaican tenor Steve Higgins will present an exciting evening of inspirational and gospel favorites on Saturday, April 25th, 4 p.m. at St. Paul's AME Church, 2024 Ashby Avenue in Berkeley. Doors open at 3 p.m., showtime 4 p.m. Proceeds from this fundraising event will benefit the Jamaican American Association of Northern California Scholarship Fund and the St. Paul AME Church Men's Ministry. Steve Higgins sang and toured internationally with the Jamaican folk singers for 20 years. He appears locally and internationally as a tenor soloist and an accomplished and respected master of ceremonies. Jamaican tenor Steve Higgins, Saturday, April 25th. 4 p.m. at St. Paul's AME Church in Berkeley. For more information,